You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniele Friberencini.
Hello, Richard.
That's never more appropriate.
You've got I'm allowing you one more week of that since it's the Giro presentation. Since it's the Giro presentation, otherwise, after that, the nonsense has to end.
What would convince you to allow me to carry on with that?
I don't know.
Screw don't give him the choice.
An Italian passport. Maybe that'd be nice.
Retweet if you like it. Like if you want me to stop.
You don't even know how to spell it.
We'll do a Twitter poll. That's what we'll do.
You don't even know how to spell it.
Anyway, television's Daniel Freib. We're in late October, and we're watching the Giro presentation. We're all hooked up to the Giro presentation happening in Milan at the moment, aren't we? What's going on there at the moment, Daniel?
Gianni Bugno's fiddling with his shoes in a slightly suspicious fashion in the front row.
His rucksack. He's got his rucksack out.
Yeah, and the host is now interviewing, I think it's a member of the Frecciazzurre, the blue arrows, which is kind of the Italian equivalent of the red arrows, the sort of display team. What's the correct terminology? The sort of fighter plane display outfit. Because there's a stage of the Giro, I think I'm right in saying that it's going to be setting out from their base in Friuli, so in the north, the far northeast of Italy. It's the stage that finishes at Piancavallo.
I thought you were going to say there was going to be a stage of the Giro conducted in fighter planes. Obviously not.
No,
Lionel. Thanks for that suggestion, though. Right, well, we are going to be talking about the Giro route, aren't we, in this episode later on. We're going to hear from James Knox and Teo Gegenhart as well in this episode later on. We're going to talk about the retiring Taylor Finney as well. And we've got a news roundup in a moment. But we've got some news ourselves, haven't we, first? We announced our lineups for the shows that we're doing in November last week. And this week we're confirming our special guests for a few of those shows. London on the 18th of November at the Arts Theatre in London. We will have Matt White joining us again, an old favourite, really insightful and entertaining as Matt. So we're delighted that he's coming back, and he'll be joining myself, Lionel, Orla Chinoui and Francois Thomazeau, who's another addition to that lineup. And then a week later, back in London on the 25th of November, Adam Blythe is going to be joining us for that one, also at the Arts Theatre. That'll be Adam Blythe, me, Lionel and Daniel. And Adam Blythe will also join us in Manchester on the 30th of November. So get your tickets at thecyclingpodcast.com. We go from Bristol to Cardiff to Worcester, Dublin and Belfast in the first week, and then London, and then London again, and then Cambridge, Edinburgh, Leicester, and Manchester. So get your tickets at thecyclingpodcast.com, and if you come along to our show, you can order a copy of our new book, The Grand Tour Diaries, in advance, and you can get 20% off it if you order it in advance and pick it up at one of the shows. It will be on sale on November the 11th, which is the date of our first show. So that's all our news, and tickets are selling really well. Belfast, Edinburgh, very close to being sold out, so get your tickets now if you haven't already done so, and you can come along. Look forward to meeting quite a lot of you there. And we've got a news roundup, I think, Lionel, do we?
We have, yeah. I was just going to say, if you're in the Cardiff or Worcester areas, do come along. We're not that there's a good crowd there, but we could sell some more tickets in both Cardiff and Worcester, so if you can get to either of those events on November the 12th and November the 13th, then go to thecyclingpodcast.com to order your tickets. But yes, Richard, the news roundup. Well, the World Tour has finally come to a close for 2019. The Tour of Guangxi in China was won by Enric Mas, his final race for De Koenig Quickstep before joining Movistar next season. He won the hilly stage. All the others went to the sprinters. There were two stage wins for Fernando Gaviria, 2 for Pascal Ackerman, 1 for Dan McClay, who's leaving EF Education First to join Arkea Samsic. Enric Mas's victory made it 68 wins for De Koninck Quickstep this season, disappointingly falling 5 short of their 73 victories last year. But I'm not sure Patrick Lefebvre will be too unhappy with that. Still an incredible rate of victory over the course of the season.
And they won the first World Tour race of the season as well, you will recall.
Long time ago now, that feels, was back in January time, but yes. And the women's race were a one-day race in China there, and that was won by Chloe Hosking. The Japan Cup in Japan was won by Bauke Mollema, who beat Mike Woods. 43-year-old Francesco Mancebo was fourth. I thought Daniel might have something to say about that, or keep an eye on the older riders in the peloton that are still going strong. You're a big fan of Davide Rebellin, aren't you, Daniel?
Am I a big fan? I don't know. I'm a keen follower of him and his vegan recipes that he posts, and you can buy off his website for, I think, the going rate is about 50 euro cents for one of his partners.
Have you bought any?
No, I haven't. I haven't, but they look splendid.
Can you do that? Well, I think you can claim that back from the Cycling Podcast if you want buy one and try it out.
What would you like me to... What do you fancy? Do you fancy a dessert? A vegan dessert? Some kind of, I don't know, vegan tiramisu?
I think a nice spaghetti bolognese, please, okay. Daniel. A
three-course meal, please, Daniel. I think this could be a follow-up to the Cassoulet special from a couple of years ago. Daniel cooks a vegan recipe, vegan meal for six, using Davide Rebellin's recipes. That surely challenge accepted, no?
Yes. Anyway, moving on, Lionel.
Okay, yeah, on the track, I know, big fan of indoor cycling, Daniel. The track season is well underway. The European Track Championships were held last week. Elia Viviani, who already has his sights set well on the Tokyo Olympics, won the elimination race there, and he's now racing on the track at the London 6 Day, which people can watch on Eurosport if they are interested in watching the 6 Day. Mark Cavendish is in action there as well, as is Caleb Ewan. We reported a couple of weeks ago that Eddy Merckx had had a nasty fall on his bike while out riding with some friends in Belgium. He came out of hospital last week and is on the mend. Tom Bonan had a crash motor racing in Belgium. I don't know too much more about this story, Daniel. Is that something that's caught your eye? Did you even know Tom Bonan was now a racing car driver?
Me? I had a long conversation with Tom Bonan about it at the Tour de France. It was quite embarrassing because after a couple of minutes of discussing this with him, and he's extremely charming gentleman, Tom Bonan, he indulges any kind of idiot who rocks up and asks him stupid questions about his motor racing career, because I knew absolutely nothing. I was under the impression that he was sort of, you know, Sunday league level, kind of village, if such a thing exists, like village motor racing. And he very patiently explained that he was sort of on the cusp of qualifying for Le Mans, at which point I sort of sheepishly scuttled away. But yeah, he's a very serious motor racing driver, isn't he?
Well, he had a bit of a crash, but is okay. But that certainly was big news in the Belgian newspapers online, certainly at the start of the week. Continuing the motor-paced theme, well, Tom Bonan's not doing motor pacing, is he? But Niels Ekhof, who won the under-23 road race at the World Championships in Harrogate last month and was then disqualified for taking a long tow behind a car as he sought to get back to the peloton after a crash. He is taking his case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, apparently. So we will see what happens with that. Could be tricky, that one, for the UCI because, well, Samuele Battistella was on the same day announced as the world champion, but Ekhof is not taking the commissaire's decision lying down and looks set to make a legal challenge. So we'll watch and see
Sorry to interrupt you, Lionel, but I bring important news from the Giro d'Italia presentation where Max Chiandri has just been interviewed. Now, the interview was going along the line of front row guests, and he interviewed Giuseppe Soroni and then skipped Fabio Baldato and went straight to Max Chiandri. So I don't know what Chiandri said then, but of course he was the DS at Movistar this year, or the team that Richard Carapaz, the winner, was riding for. But more on this later.
The Cyclocross World Cup is back in Europe after two rounds in the US. Elie Isabeat of Belgium, who won both of those races in America, has made it 3 out of 3. Anne-Marie Voorst won the women's race for the Netherlands. A fair bit of controversy brewing surrounding the 2020-21 World Cup for Cyclocross next season. It's due to expand from 9 to 16 events, and Flanders Classics, which is the company that runs the Tour of Flanders and many of the other big Flandrian classics, funnily enough, is taking on the organisation of the Cyclocross World Cup from next year, and 8 of the 16 events are due to take place in Belgium. Now, a lot of people in the cyclocross world are not 100% happy about this, one of them being Sven Nys, a 6-time World Cup winner and former world champion, being very critical, saying that being outside of the World Cup schedule will potentially kill off some of the traditional but smaller events, and is not necessarily sure that this new development is in the interest of cyclocross as a whole. Again, we'll watch and see how that develops. The UCI is, at the risk of suggesting they make a pig's ear of things, the World Tour lineup for 2020 has been confirmed, with Cofidis getting the 19th World Tour license for the next phase of the World Tour, which is basically a 3-year license. Arkea Samsic, Nairo Quintana and Warren Barguil's team have not got a World Tour place for next season. Total Direct Energy will get a wild card to the Grand Tours, and Wanty Group Gobert will get a wild card to the new Classic Series of one-day races. But it basically means that in the case of the Tour de France, we're likely to see Arkea Samsic, Wanty Group Gobert and B&B Hotels Vital Concept fighting it out for two of the wild card places. But contrary to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago about the shortage of wildcard places for Italian teams at the Giro d'Italia, it does seem to offer some hope for more than one Italian team, non-World Tour team, getting a place in the Giro d'Italia. But this is, it's not a terribly clear situation at this moment. This news has been confirmed in the last few hours, and we're still kind of getting to grips with the implications and the consequences of the new World Tour lineup. So again, we'll monitor that as people presumably express their dissatisfaction at the way that it's all been ironed out. A story that caught my eye on Cycling News concerning Sam Bennett, the Bora Hansgrohe rider whose future is as yet it's uncertain for next year, isn't it? There's been lots of rumours that he's off to De Koenig Quickstep, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And Cycling News have a story suggesting that Bora Hansgrohe offered to swap Sam Bennett for Alvaro Hodge. Sprinter for sprinter swap. Patrick Lefevre dismissed that. And finally, and we'll talk about this in the next part of the podcast, Taylor Finney of EF Education First has announced his retirement. More about that after the break.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
It's difficult. I can only speak from a male's perspective, but it's difficult for the modern male to feel confident when wearing spandex and or lycra. My name is Taylor Finney, and I ride for EF Education First Pro Cycling Team. Therefore, your comfort and your confidence is essential when you're putting on your bicycle clothing. I will admit that this is the most comfortable and the most confident that I've felt. They are the best bib shorts in the world.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our title sponsor. Very grateful to them for their ongoing support, of course. And the voice there was none other than Taylor Finney, of course, the EF Education First rider. Maybe the last time we'll hear that message from him about his Rafa bib shorts. But he is retiring, as you mentioned at the end of the news roundup, Lionel.
He's finished his excellent adventure, and he's off on his bogus journey now.
Come on now, Daniel. We are going to talk about Taylor Finney in this part, I think. Just before we do, another little announcement. We are taking part in the Ruler Classic which is on the 1st of November. The Ruler Classic is over 3 days, the Thursday, the 31st of October, Friday, the 1st of November, and Saturday, the 2nd of November. We're on the 1st of November. It'll be myself, Lionel, and Francois Tomazo, and we're really looking forward to that. It's a great lineup. Greg LeMond is among the galaxy of stars there. If you want to come and see us and others at the Ruler Classic in London, go to rulerclassic.cc, rulerclassic.cc. Tickets still available. But we look forward to seeing a few friends of the podcast there. It'll be a good warm-up for our grand tour. But chaps, Taylor Finney, well, he announced his retirement last week. We knew he was out of contract. He's had a couple of years at EF Education first, after many years at BMC, where he was on a very big contract, certainly when he first joined that team. Had a terrible crash a few years ago in the US Championships, and really did some serious damage to his leg. And, you know, there were very serious questions about whether he would come back to the sport at all. He did, and, you know, posted some decent results, top 10 at Paris-Roubaix, but perhaps never got back to the level that he was at when he was talked about as, you know, a future Paris-Roubaix winner. I remember following him, BMC, in a team time trial on one occasion. I think it was the Tour of Qatar in 2013. I was in the car following him and his team. And, you know, for the length of that race, he basically just sat at the front. And I think they might have won the stage, if I remember correctly, but he just sat on the front that virtually the whole way. It was almost an individual time trial. He was incredibly strong, big, powerful rider. But, you know, he retires at just 29. I think he's got other strings to his bow, as you hinted at, Daniel. But a lot of coverage of Finney's retirement, as you probably expect. I made a facetious little comment on Twitter.
You did. Very well, contentious. It was very unfair, yeah, I thought. Very unfair.
Yeah, well, it wasn't there was no judgment in it at all, or comment. It could be read in any way that people wanted. I just contrasted the reaction to Taylor Finney's retirement to that of Simon Spielak. You know, if you look at just their palmares, Spielak's got a better record. He's won more bigger races, but I don't know if people realised or even noticed he was around when he was around. Never mind that he's just recently announced his retirement. Finney is a very different beast, wasn't he?
So you've thrown another grenade now. You've taken the pin out of another grenade and you've run for cover yet again. No, I think you're right, Rich. I didn't quite appreciate what kind of an upward curve Taylor Finney was on before his crash, which was...
Sorry, I thought we were talking about Simon Spielak.
15. Well, we will in a second. I'd sort of, you know, forgotten how kind of meteoric his rise had been in his first 3 or 4 years as a professional. I think one of the results that really stood out for me was, I think his second place in the World Championship time trial in Valkenburg. Was it in Valkenburg? Yeah, it was. Just behind Tony Martin, a few seconds behind, 5 seconds behind. And the next rider in third place was Vasyl Kiryienko, who was a minute 44 behind. And that was really when Tony Martin was at his absolute peak. And Finney was only in his early 20s, a third-year professional. And that was sort of typical of his time trialing back then, and he looked as though he was sort of the next man in line, that the kind of heir to Tony Martin's throne. And we see this with the sort of title, official or unofficial, of the best time trialist in the world. It tends to go in sort of 3 or 4 year cycles. We had Cancellara, then Martin, and as I say, it looked as though Finney was going to be the next guy, and his momentum was really sort of shot down by that crash in 2015. There were another couple of rides he did, particularly after his crash, when he came back in 2016, which suggested to me he might have a bit of a future as as a sprinter, or as an unconventional kind of sprinter. He won a couple of times with sort of long efforts sort of in the last kilometer or in the last sort of 500 meters, going from further out than a sprinter would usually go. But it did remind me slightly of other sprinters of that ilk we've seen before, kind of Alessandro Patakis and that sort of rider who started life as more of a powerful rider than a fast rider. But that didn't really sort of crystallize either. And I think if you spoke to people who worked with and rode with Finney over the last few years, they would say his character had changed quite a lot after the crash. He wasn't the sort of quite the same single-minded, focused alpha male that he'd been in the early part of his career.
I think, isn't it fair to say that the reaction to Finney's retirement, two reasons really. One, because he's still only 29, and two, because he is American cycling royalty, isn't he? I mean, his mum was Connie Carpenter before she married Davis Finney. She won the first Olympic road race in 1984, and Davis Finney, of course, Tour de France stage winner, and so, you know, has the genetics to be a top level rider. Was kind of one of Jonathan Vaughter's pet projects, wasn't he, from a young age, taken onto the Slipstream team at I think the age of only 15 or 16, and then there was a bit of a tug of love over him between Vaughters and Lance Armstrong, because Finney then moved on to the Trek Livestrong development team and made his way into the World Tour from there, and won the prologue of the Giro in Herning in Denmark when still only 21. And so, you know, the talent was there and was obvious. And even when you look at back-to-back wins in the under-23 Paris-Roubaix, I was looking at the type of riders that finished behind him, and you wouldn't sort of say that he beat, you know, sort of a generation of superstars there. But I do think that race is a reasonable indicator of talent, particularly since those couple of years that Finney won it. Since then, Bob Jungels has won it, Mike Tournison's won, Filippo Ganna, Niels Eekhoff, who we mentioned a little bit earlier, won a couple of years ago the under-23 Paris-Roubaix. And so there was an awful lot of expectation around Finney. And
so much so, Napalm. So just to interject, I think I'm right in saying he was the best, and he might still be the best paid near pro of all time. There were some crazy figures that were being bandied around when he did turn pro with BMC, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I think back to 2012, and, you know, missed out on a medal in both the road race and the time trial at the Olympic Games in London. Sorry, 2012, that was. That clearly, it was a career that, you know, threatened to be great, but then that terrible crash at the US Pro Champs in 2014, you know, really set him back several. Rungs, I guess, and I suppose you could say that just coming back and making it to the Tour de France was an achievement in itself. You know, 2017 was his debut at the Tour. He rode it twice, 2017 and 2018, and, you know, that might not have happened. You know, the crash was so severe that the comeback was not something that, you know, he could have taken for granted.
Yeah, I wonder if he had a sort of mental checklist and top 10 in Paris-Roubaix and a ride at the Tour de France might have been the things post-crash that have allowed him to retire with sort of peace of mind about his cycling career. I remember at that tour that he rode in Dusseldorf, I met his parents, Davis Finney and Connie Carpenter, and spoke to them at the start of the first road stage where he got away with Juan Alfredo, do you remember? And, you know, normally two riders away on the first road stage of the tour is pretty routine for the bunch to catch them, but it was a sort of measure of how strong those two were that they were out there till about a kilometre to go, and it looked touch and go for a while whether they might stay away. And it was, I suppose, evidence again of what a big engine Finney had, although he said in some interviews that, you know, his strength on his left side, where he had the injuries, was, you know, nothing like what it had been pre-crash. But, you know, seeing his family there, and his father suffers from Parkinson's disease, and they were riding their bikes, and you know, I got a sense from them as well of what it meant to them as a family to have him ride the Tour de France finally. So, you know, I wonder if, you know, he is 29, but that stuck in my mind that perhaps that and the Paris-Roubaix finish might have been enough for him to just feel, you know, content with his career. He obviously had a lot of other things going on. A few of those interests developed, I think, in his convalescence, art and so on. And I think they've maybe assumed a bigger role in his life. But there was I mentioned Rafa, our sponsor. They also produce these behind-the-scenes films, EF Gone Racing. And there was one they did a couple of months ago at Leadville, the mountain bike race, where it was Alex Howes, Lachlan Morton and Taylor Finney all taking part. And Finney didn't ride. He had an injury. But I don't know, watching that, it was quite poignant, his decision to not take the start of the race, I thought. I'd sensed that his body was kind of letting him down a bit, and his head maybe wasn't fully in it. So not a huge surprise, I don't think, that he's decided to call it a day.
Well, Rich, also, we're talking about the challenge of him coming back after his crash in 2015. But for a lot of guys like him, something we don't often talk about, we don't often consider, is that it can also be a decision, in the sense that a rider like Finney would have stood to earn quite a lot of money from insurance payments had he not come back. I think probably in the millions. And that was a decision he had to take, and I suppose that's worth bearing in mind. There were times over the last two or three years when you felt his mind and his motivation were elsewhere, but he was certainly motivated enough, felt stimulated enough to want to give it another shot, and I suppose he deserves quite a bit of credit for that.
But also, don't you think, I mean, it's not like he has to just carry on in cycling because he has no other ideas what he wants to do with his life. I mean, you never got the sense that Taylor Finney would struggle to make some kind of mark on the world if he wasn't a professional cyclist. So, you know, it's a luxury that not a lot of people have, actually, is to be able to call it quits on your own terms and decide that you want to call it a day when you want to call it a day.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, that's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, of course, reminding me to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is supported by Stitch Fix. Now, Stitch Fix is a company, an online styling company, that helps you find the perfect item of clothing or items of clothing. We all know that shopping can be a bit of a pain, don't we, Lionel? It's all a bit overwhelming. Dressing rooms are unpleasant. That's why Katrina Lake, a Harvard graduate who wanted to dress well, but without the pain of shopping, started Stitch Fix. It's an online personal styling service that takes the work out of dressing well. It's fun and light touch. You fill in a quiz when you sign up to Stitch Fix. A personal stylist will then send you 5 items of clothing, each hand picked for you from the selection of 100 of the best European brands, including established names, cool emerging designers, and exclusive brands. You get to try on everything when it arrives, and if you don't like something or if it doesn't fit properly, you can send it back. Delivery and returns are both free. So there's very little to lose, and you can get started with Stitch Fix today and support the cycling podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. That's Stitch Fix, stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Lionel, you took a delivery of Stitch Fix clothing, didn't you, with a very specific kind of brief?
I did, yeah. I was a little bit sceptical. As you'd imagine, Richard, trawling around the shops looking for things, trying things on, really not my bag at all. But I wasn't sure that anyone else could assemble an outfit for me that wouldn't look like I'd kind of fallen into a wardrobe and come out in a random assortment of things, particularly when all they've got to go on is the information that I was giving them, which was, well, I did my best. You know, I filled out the questionnaire as best I could. And, what I got in my Stitch Fix pack was a very nice and really well-cut dark blazer and a pair of jeans which fitted. You know, I don't know whether I'm an unusual shape, but I do seem to struggle a bit with jeans. Maybe you keep referring to my stumpy legs, Richard, but the jeans fitted perfectly. And I had a choice of shirts and a jumper, and I opted for a long sleeve dark shirt, which I felt very comfortable in. And well, the proof of the pudding is in the fact that I didn't send any of the items back. I actually kept them all and paid for them all with my own money. Well, you can't say fairer than that. And not only that, but I've asked for another Stitch Fix delivery in time for our November tour, so I'll see if anything comes out of that.
Well, give it a go. Stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. That's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. So, chaps, the Giro d'Italia route presentation has now finished. What have we learned, Daniel? Where are we going in 2020?
Well, Rich, I think we knew we were starting off in Hungary, 3 days in Hungary. The race starts in Budapest, and I guess most people expected there to be a rest day after three stages. There is not going to be a rest day, so the race is going to resume straight away on the fourth day in Sicily. It's a long old poke from Hungary to Sicily.
Maybe the Blue Arrows can get involved.
Well, yeah, we better get looking at flights tomorrow, hadn't we? Vueling and all those boys, here we come.
Sorry to interject already, but I met a couple of DSs coming out of a team meeting at Il Lombardia the night before Il Lombardia, where they'd been told this by RCS, or told the arrangements for the transfer to Sicily, and they were pretty unhappy because it's going to put a big strain on riders and resources, you would think. So the riders apparently will, the stage in Hungary, stage three, will be finished at a normal time. The riders will then all eat together, apparently, and then fly to Sicily, and the stage the next day will start at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And I was told that Sicily have a long-term agreement with RCS to have the Giro going there quite regularly over the next few years. But it also owes to a new UCI rule, which is that there can only be an early rest day, i.e. in the first week, I think, or maybe first week or 10 days, every 4 years. So a Grand Tour can only apply for that every 4 years. And the Giro, although the rules only just come in, the Giro did it last year, of course, with the start in Israel. And that seems to have scuppered their presumed plans to have an early rest day next year.
I mean, this is a ridiculous rule. I mean, what's the point of this rule? I mean, the races are under pressure for commercial reasons to seek new ground, to take the races to places that are willing to pay, to host the start.
Well,
you know, the money.
Somebody suggested to me, Lionel, that the rule may have been applied through pressure by ASO. This is scurrilous rumour and gossip, but ASO, mindful of their position as the premier Grand Tour, are looking at the Giro and what they're doing with their ever more exotic starts, and they're just kind of pulling rank a little bit because it's not something the Tour has done at all.
So, Rich, we have our 3 days in Hungary. Three flat stages, first stage is a time trial, and then two stages for the sprinters. We know Peter Sagan's going to be there. It's about an hour from, we're going to be about an hour from the Slovak border when we start in Budapest. So there'll be a lot of Sagan fans. And then 3 days in Sicily with a mountaintop finish at Etna. A different climb of Etna from the last time we went up. It's a long climb, I think about 17 kilometers, pretty steady, or about a 7% gradient. So a good test. And thereafter, there's another tough stage a couple of days later in the deep south of Italy. And then there's a long stretch of what look on paper to be relatively flat stages. Now, last year at the Giro, we all felt, didn't we, that Maravegni had kind of under-egged the pudding in terms of difficulty in terms of drama, particularly in the early part of the race. And looking at this year's Giro route, the sort of general profile, you might be forgiven for reaching the same conclusion again. It looks certainly less undulating than Giri of the last 10 years. I mean, if you sort of zoom in a little bit, there are, in that middle week, there are some gnarly stages, the stage to Tortoreto Lido on the Adriatic coast. There's a difficult finish that day with a little climb that the race is going to go up three or four times, I think. And then the sort of Pantani stage, what people will call the Marco Pantani stage, Cesenatico to Cesenatico, goes inland on a lot of the roads that might be familiar to listeners who have done Nove Colli, Gran Fondo, a very famous Gran Fondo that takes place near there. Not high climbs, they go up to sort of 500 to 800 meters, but they're steep in places and quite difficult, so that will be a challenging day. And then we're into the tail, the sort of rattle of the snake, with five consecutive difficult, very difficult stages. There's the wine stage in Napalm. It's a Prosecco wine stage. We've already had a Prosecco time trial in the Giro, which was in, I think, 2014. Am I right in thinking? 2015. And it was a time trial won by Vasil Kirienka. The difference this time is they're calling it the Prosecco Superiore. So, well, you know, I think that's just a fairly gratuitous way of differentiating it from 2015. I would have been more impressed if they'd called it the Cartizze stage. Cartizze is the superiore, the best Prosecco you can get, but Cartizze is just one small little hill outside Val d'Obbiadene, which is... Napalm, you're a bit of a Prosecco expert now, aren't you?
I'm still very much champagne when it comes to the fizzy wines.
We introduced to one sparkling wine a year, don't we? A couple of years ago, it was Franciacorta. Last year, you had your champagne crash course, didn't you? Not Laurent.
It was a crash course, Daniel. That was a full immersion.
Well, there you go. And then this year...
I wallowed in champagne, Daniel. Don't
you
worry.
Bathing in champagne.
we're back to the old Prosecco. And then, so after that time trial, we've got... four hilly stages. Piancavallo, you'll remember there, Nairo Quintana took the pink jersey, short-lived that was, a couple of years ago. Remember, Rich, we had a fantastic rendition of the Nairo Quintana song by Dino Zandegu at the summit there. So that's a summit finish in Friuli. It's a long climb, quite a steady climb, but the kind of climb that does quite a lot of damage. Then there's a stage to San Daniele del Friuli, very famous for its ham. Napalm is kind of the hipster's Parma ham, nowhere near Parma, but it's very similar, kind of cured ham, San Daniele. And that's going to be an interesting day because there's a difficult climb sort of just outside Udine that the race is going to go up three times. The Monte Ragogna, I think it's called. And then two mountain stages. One, Madonna di Campiglio, infamous, because that was where Marco Pantani was kicked out of the 1999 Giro d'Italia, and that sort of precipitated his downfall. So there's a certain finish there. The following day, the race goes up the Stelvio, and then comes down the Stelvio into Bormio and then turns up to a new finish, which is called the Laghi di Cancano. Not particularly remarkable or difficult climb, but a climb nonetheless after Stelvio. One more flat stage through Piemonte, finishing in Asti. Napalm, hopefully we'll be staying that night in the hotel we were last year in Barbaresco. Have a lovely glass of Barbaresco that night. Then I'll be off because this year, unusually, the Dauphiné starts on the same weekend that the Giro finishes, and I'm going to have to be at the Dauphiné. So I'll be gone. The buff, you'll be brought back in. Tactical substitution.
I might be there already.
You might be there already. You might well be there already. The grand finale, really, and where the race might well be decided, is in the last mountain stage through the Alps to Sestriere, and it'll be going over the Colle dell'Agnello 2,744 meters, just slightly lower than the Stelvio, and it'll go over the Izoard, the Monginevro, and finish at Sestria. And that's it. There will actually be another opportunity to gain time in the final day time trial to Milan. So three time trials in total. Not a huge amount of a massive number of kilometers against the clock overall when you add it all together, but still three time trials. And overall, I would suggest not the most inspiring Giro route I've seen. Not too many sort of interesting new climbs or really particularly steep climbs. There are some real classics there: the Stelvio, the Izoard, of course, in France, the Agnello. But there is also the big risk that it's going to be affected by weather, because you know the three climbs that I mentioned there—they're all well over 2,000 meters high. We know what has happened in past Giri with the snow at that time of year in the middle of May. So I think there'll be some nervous days for the race organisers before the race reaches those climbs.
Yeah, it seems ever more unpredictable, the weather. Richard Carapaz was there at the presentation today, and he confirmed that he will ride the Giro next year. He'll be riding for Team Ineos, of course. I have to say, the Giro did a very nice thing. They obviously sent a film crew over to Ecuador and interviewed his parents and shot a little film about Ecuador and young cyclists there, and it was pretty moving, actually, and I thought it was a nice thing to do. The tour didn't really do anything like that with Bernal last week, who was of course first Colombian winner of the tour, or was it 2 weeks ago, the tour presentation, or was it last week? I can't remember, but it was, yeah, I thought it was worth commenting on because it was a nice touch.
Well, the thing that leaps out at me, Daniel, is the length of some of the stages. 10 of the stages are over 200 kilometres, and there's a couple of absolute brutes in there, isn't there? The flat one to Asti, 251 kilometres. I mean, that seems excessive on the final Friday.
It's not going to be popular, is it?
That's not going to be popular, I don't think. No, not sandwiched between two five-star mountain stages, which are also 200 kilometres and a bit long. Well, one's 200 kilometres to Sestriere and the other is 209 kilometres, the one that goes over the Stelvio. That looks like pretty unpopular scheduling to me. But also the kind of, the back-to-back 200-kilometre-plus stages in the first week, I suppose it does balance out a little bit with some of the shorter ones. But if the payoff for your short stage is... Or rather the reason for one of the short stages is because everyone's got to fly from Hungary to Sicily. I mean, that doesn't give the riders a lot of downtime. So it's a funny one. And, there's a lot of coastal riding as well. Ciro will be happy, I guess, with plenty of beaches on the way across the bottom of the foot and then up the back of the leg. But, it's an interesting route in the sense that the first big test for the climbers comes nice and early on Etna, a different way up. We've seen they seem to be making regular visits to Etna now over the last few years. So, and it's good that it's not just the same type of stage each time, the same type of climb. I just think that the Giro's big conundrum there, getting from Hungary to Sicily, it'd be fascinating to know how they'd sort of come up with that, because driving from Hungary, they could have made their way straight across, couldn't they?
They could come through Slovenia. It's 550 kilometres from Budapest to Trieste, and that would be an interesting, three days you could do that in, couldn't you? By stage four, you could be in Trieste and then working your way down to Venice. And I guess what has hamstrung them here perhaps is this commitment to go to Sicily. But why not finish the Giro in Sicily on Etna?
Wow. In the crater. Why not finish in the crater, Rich?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why not?
That'd be exciting, wouldn't it?
It would. Yeah, all these ideas. Maro Venue, if you're listening.
Wow, yeah. I mean, that's something that would definitely give the Giro some... a very strong identity. But on that issue of identity, it seems to me that they are, and particularly Venyi, has really decided that this is going to be the length of the stages, and this kind of almost throwback nature of the Giro is now going to be its identity, with these kind of classic climbs, the you know, names that we've all heard and kind of revered over the years, the Stelvio, the Izoard, very long stages. But I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that you see the attrition that we're often told we're going to see. For example, last year, the balance of power was established quite early on, after about 10 stages. Carapaz was clearly the strongest in the race after about 10 or 12 stages. And we didn't really see that much kind of yo-yoing and people blowing up spectacularly at the very back end of the race, did we? And I think that's what they want to see. They want to be able to show that to people and say, look, you know, this is what happens when you wear people down with very long stages. The real sort of cream rises to the top at the end. But I'm not sure that it makes all that much difference. And another thing that jumps out at me is that the transfers, you know, we always hear complaints, well, from the journalists and also the riders about the transfers at the Giro, and indeed any, all of the Grand Tours, but particularly at the Giro. And I can see some gnarly ones here as well. Not necessarily, you know, 300-400 kilometer ones, but just ones that could take 2 or 3 hours, every evening. So it's going to be a long, odd slog.
The thing is, though, Daniel, I mean, until we know the makeup of the lineup, it's very difficult to second guess the impact that the route will have. And the thing this year with Carapaz was that no one really knew that he was the nut they'd have to crack until it was too late. And that was, you know, that was the problem. I think pretty much everyone, including ourselves, underestimated Carapaz until, well, then suddenly he was in the pink jersey and never looking like he was going to let go of it, not least because Roglic had his sort of condition had gone in the opposite direction. I think that the thing is with these big mountain stages at the end, assuming that they're not affected by weather, you know, that's a lot of climbing in the space of 5 or 6 days with still a time trial to come at the end. The Giro will be decided in that block, won't it, from the Saturday time trial in wine country, in Prosecco country, and then those mountain stages. There's plenty there to get excited about. It's just whether or not that first 10 days is reminiscent of a couple of Giri in succession. The one that Nibali won, which again burst into life in the final week after quite a slow opening fortnight, and the Dumoulin one was you know, was pretty calm for a week or so. It looks to me like it's a bit more that kind of pattern than perhaps last year's, but we shall wait and see. Certainly think that the fact that Peter Sagan is going to ride livens up the flat stages. Sagan has never ridden the Giro before. You know, the chances are that he could, if he were to go all the way to the finish, you know, he certainly could win a stage or two, and could win the purple, sorry, Ciclomino jersey for the points competition. And at least maybe sort of, it might make the race for the green jersey at the Tour de France a little bit more interesting if Sagan's already got the Giro in his legs.
I think one thing we can say, Napal, and what's going to be a talking point over the next few weeks, obviously, is the super teams, the Jumbo-Vismas and the Ineoses, who are they going to pick for the Tour, who they're going to pick to the Giro, how they're going to divide their resources. And I think maybe this Giro route might help them to make up their minds, in the sense that it's very different from the Tour de France route. We talked about how climb heavy that was throughout, from the first couple of days in Nice. This looks quite different to me, and the time trialing, the extra time trialing, I'm just counting up the kilometers, it's going to be over 50 kilometers of time trials in the Giro. So you would think that that sort of pushes Tom Dumoulin in the direction of the Giro. I always feel that it's a race that he always wants to do, and he's always reluctant not to do it. That said, Roglic is also a brilliant time trialist, so I'm sure he'd be quite happy to do the Giro. And as far as Ineos are concerned, I think there's been a lot of talk of Geraint Thomas targeting the Giro. Well, with that amount of time trialing in the route, I think he'll be quite happy with what he's seen today.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, and still offering 25% off to you, the listeners, if you go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Now, in this final part, we are going to hear a couple of interviews. Just before we do, we recently released our friend's special, the road trip from the Tour de France. That was, I don't know what you call it, Lionel, offcuts. It was conversations that you, me and Francois Thomazeau had in the car at the restaurant table in the Laurent Perrier Champagne Chateau and in other places. And that's a two-part episode available to Friends of the Podcast. We've got a final Friends of the Podcast episode coming out in 2019. And that's the idea that has been suggested by one of our high-paying friends. They all submitted ideas before the tour. We went through them at the tour. That conversation is part one of this special, and part two will be the idea itself. I'll not reveal yet what that idea was. And you can still become a friend of the podcast for 2019 at thecyclingpodcast.com. And the final Friends special of 2019 will be followed by our Friends program for 2020, which should be rolling out in the next month or so. Shall we hear these interviews? I did a couple of interviews with two young riders the day before Il Lombardia, James Knox and Theo Gegenhardt. James Knox we followed pretty closely at the Vuelta a España. He kept an audio diary for us. People, I think, enjoyed his insights into the race. He finished 11th in the end on GC, and it was a pretty eventful final week for him. So caught up with him a few weeks after that race, and also Theo Gegenhardt, who had a very different Vuelta and a very different season, just to get both of their thoughts on how they felt their season had gone. First James Knox, then Theo Gegenhardt. Was this always in the plan? I can't remember. You spoke to you at the Vuelta about what you were doing after the Vuelta, and I think it was a bit up in there, but was this week of racing one that you were always going to do?
Yeah, actually, I think I knew about finishing the season in Lombardia since maybe around the Giro, so this was always a plan. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty at the end of the world about whether I do the Worlds, and that was basically the only thing that was going to change.
Did you feel that you missed out the Worlds? I don't know if you watched much of the race.
I watched it from the comfort of my own sofa. It was a pretty crazy race, just with the weather and everything. I mean, I was disappointed not to be there. A home world championship, not far from where I'm from, and my mum and dad went and watched and everything, and there was, yeah, I think it would have been really special to have been there, but I've got to be honest, sat on the settee, it was it felt like I'd been dealt a nice hand. Not been there.
How were you after the Vuelta? Because, you know, the last few days in particular, you went pretty deep, I think, just to finish. You had some misfortune where you had the crash, and it was quite a dramatic, eventful last few days for you. How did you feel at the end of it all, you know, Monday morning when you woke up in Madrid, apart from the hangover, how did you feel?
Yeah, I was completely ruined. You know, we went out Sunday night, which doesn't make it any better, does it? It's not really the smartest time for a big night out, and then crawled back to Girona, where I spent a bit of time as well. And I went into what I've sort of noticed this before, you go into like a bit of a depression. I think being away where you get taken care of, then you got to take care of yourself, and also just been so completely destroyed. Not really having the energy to do anything. So it's just like a little revolving spiral of negativity where you feel like you should be doing something, you're too tired to do anything. And it just goes on and on and on. I took a week off the bike in the end. I was pretty worried about the knee as well, so I wanted to take some time off and let that heal up. It was pretty bashed up. I think it's definitely the most, you know, like, I can't really say tired either, because tired isn't the right word. It's just like, just wasted, you know? You're just so completely done with everything. And I went into a little hole for a week, 10 days. I made the terrible decision of organising with fellow Cumbrian, Mike Donovan, to move apartments in Girona. He was coming back from Tour of Britain and I was coming back from the Vuelta, and it was like the only time that seemed to fit for us both to just make this change. And yeah, I made Mark do most of the work, to be honest, because I just wasn't up to it, and he basically carried me through that, so apologies to him.
It's interesting you say about that. I mean, wonder if an aspect of it is that the Vuelta seemed to sort of ratchet up for you as the race went on in that final week with the crosswind stage. You know, you were kind of at the centre of a lot of stuff that was going on, and then the crash, and then the struggling through the stage and trying to hold on to your top 10. You must have been finding yourself kind of caught up in a such story around yourself as well that a lot of people were following.
Yeah, that's a strange way to put it. I didn't think of it like that. I mean, I guess you're always just focused on your own narrative, aren't you? So I didn't really think about it being important, especially with the way the first 2 weeks went, where I just sort of floated around in no man's land, just sort of hovering. I think maybe after that second rest day, just sort of, or coming into that second rest day, just got to get into the top 20, and then that maybe, yeah, actually just that second rest day was where I got into top 10 with that breakaway, and then it was suddenly, yeah, breakaway before the rest day, crosswinds after, another mountain stage, the day I crashed, then the final day to hold on. So yeah, that was a really, really full-on way to finish. And you know,
a lot of intensity in that.
Yeah, and especially because I felt like I rode into some really good form. You know, the first week I wasn't particularly feeling great, and then completely just left it all, you know. Wasn't sort of, I never really had any of those days where I never completely sat up, you know. I wasn't expecting to ride that sort of race. I had no ambition of riding for GC. I just sort of went there, see how it would go, hoping to get in some breakaways. Managed to do that, but also stay up there for GC. So, you know, it was, I think it's a big thing, finishing a 3-week Grand Tour, let alone, you know, racing every day, which, you know, so sort of 2 for the price of 1 there. You know, I managed to experience both in my, you know, my first finish. So yeah, I'm not surprised I was completely destroyed, but it doesn't change the fact how much it gets you.
Yeah, and do you reflect now on it, on the whole race, and especially the way that you raced in the final week with satisfaction?
Yeah, of course. You know, it would be nice to finish in the top 10, but I'm not at all disappointed with 11th. It's pretty crazy to think about, you know, to say that came 11th in a Grand Tour. I never thought that would be possible only a couple months ago. So yeah, really, really satisfied, and you know, moving again in the right direction, just step by step every year seems to be a lot of positives to take.
Does it give you a taste for Grand Tours and Grand Tour riding? Is that where you think you'd like your career to go?
Yeah, I mean, sort of guess I can imagine that now, what it's like. You know, I certainly feel like I'm a long way off the level of those guys climbing and everything, the way that Roglic, Podjakar, Lopez, Valverde, you know, they're just flying up climbs day after day after day. That feels like a completely different world. But you know, I gave myself some idea what it takes to ride hard for 3 weeks, and you know, seem to have sort of sussed out that I'm a bit, you know, I'm a stage racer so far with decent rides here and there. So we'll see how it develops, but you know, there's a long way to go.
Theo, how do you reflect on this season? I mean, we saw a lot of the Vuelta, and well, you rode a very aggressive race. You were, you know, you were on the attack the whole time, and I guess that was influenced by what happened in the first few days. But overall, you know, what mark out of 10 do you give yourself for this year?
That's tricky, actually. I was just stood waiting for the lift then. We sat here in the hotel just before Lombardia, and I was thinking, I knew you were going to ask me that.
Not a mark out of 10, that's quite an unusual question. Yeah, I was quite pleased with that one.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting a mark out of 10, to be fair, but the rest. It's tricky, really. I guess it's hard to look at a season as a whole because there's so many good and bad points along the way often. I think it was, in the grand scheme of things, still progression from what I'd done in the past. So yeah, perhaps maybe like a high sevens if we're going into decimal places, or like a solid 7 if we're sticking to the real numbers. But yeah, it was a tricky one. I think there was a lot of really good races where perhaps, you know, if I'd been a little bit in a different role, then I might have picked up maybe 4 or 5 wins instead of 2, and then that kind of changes the whole complexion. But as it was, my 2 big targets of the year went pretty horribly, so that also puts quite a sour note on the season, so it's a strange one really. But I still got my first pro win and GC podium, and I was, you know, I think I was really close in Poland as well, even to taking the win. Obviously Pavel did in the end, but that was another good race. So yes, it is a really tricky question. I think
7 seems quite harsh because you did win races, which not, you know, a lot of riders don't win races. But at the Vuelta, you know, have you any closer to understanding what happened in the first week? Because you were obviously, the form was there, we saw that, and you seemed to be riding almost in anger the rest of the race. There was, seemed to be frustration was driving you, and you were clearly capable of riding with the best guys in the race. What went wrong in the first week?
I think that stage in Calpe was pretty tricky. I guess I'm still understanding it fully, but I think I can be really good when everyone's fresh, but I think in the grand scheme of things, I'm probably, relatively speaking, maybe come more into my element when kind of fatigue setting into the bunch, and kind of resisting that to a certain degree. That seems to be the case anyway. So obviously that Calpe stage was the first proper stage, really tough day, and yeah, I was just exploded in the heat, which was actually unexpected because I'd been feeling really good and put quite a lot of emphasis on it in the weeks before, but the old Scottish-Irish gene pool perhaps wasn't there.
Is the heat a problem for you?
Yeah, definitely, yeah, 100%. It was in the Vuelta the year before, and hence I'd kind of put a lot more work into it. And yeah, we didn't have any kind of crazy days after that, but in the warmer ones I felt fine, but it seemed to be something like that first one. Sepp Kuss and I were talking about it the other day because he was horrid that day as well. I think he was in the group with me or maybe even further back down the road, and he was obviously flying the rest of the race, and he said he just had an awful day as well. So yeah, I just booked a test today to go and do some testing with a specialist in the UK, which is all based around sodium, so that'll be interesting. I've never done anything like that before, so maybe I won't learn anything, but that's the aim. Try use the off season to pick up on points like that. And yeah, I mean, I think if it had only been that day, it would have been okay. I mean, like, Marc Soler was in my group that day and he finished 9th on GC. But then, whatever that first summit finish was, 3 days later, I was up all night in the bathroom and then pretty violently throwing up all morning. So, yeah, that was the first time I've ever raced with kind of completely empty body, really. So it was a new experience, but that was a good way to cap off a horrendous first week, really.
Well, you did pretty well, considering. I mean, does that knowledge influence race program decisions next year? I mean, you went to the Giro this year, but would you be more likely to maybe, you know, look at the Giro next year, because obviously the heat tends not to be such a factor there?
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, in principle, yeah. I'd still like to. I really like the Vuelta. I think it's a great race. I think I just need to fine-tune a little bit more. I think I'm getting there with the heat and understanding what works for the body and stuff, but yeah, that's kind of what this test that I'm going to do is really, is like looking at sweat rate and content and stuff, and obviously everyone's bodies are different, so I don't know if it's going to help, but try, and you never know, maybe it will.
What else have you got planned for the off-season?
Yeah, I was just getting some saddles from the mechanics a couple hours ago, doing some bike fitting, new insoles. Actually, like the week or so I'm in London's filling up pretty fast, really. All those little things that you don't have time to do.
So your off-season is all bike-related. Come on, you've got a holiday coming up.
Yeah, so basically going back to the UK, doing a week of chores and buying a bit of furniture before I go back there. All these things that you don't do when you're a bike rider. And then really excited to go watch the Rams in Wembley Stadium. That'll be pretty cool. Hannah's big into her NFL now, so I'll be trying to follow along and understand, and she'll be cheering or whatever you do at NFL, eating hot dogs. And then yeah, we're off to a wedding in Georgia in the States, and visiting some friends in North Carolina who recently had a baby and we haven't met her, so that'll be lovely. And going to Asheville, which is where Hannah used to live when she was on UHC, and then jumping on another flight, of course, down to Mexico, and just trying to relax for a few days and unwind. And I think I'm a big proponent of off season. I think last year was my longest one yet, and I won't be able to take quite that long this year, just with finishing 2 weeks after the Worlds. But putting my running shoes on as well, stuff like that, just something different, and soak it up, I guess.
So that was James Knox and Theo Gegenhart reflecting on their seasons. We'll have more interviews in the coming weeks with riders, we'll begin to look ahead quite soon rather than look back, because the season will be approaching quite quickly. But anything else catch your eye at all this week, chaps? Anything in dispatches?
Yes, something's just caught my eye in the last 10 seconds. I've just seen a story in La Provence, according to which Marseille, the first ever tiramisu bar has opened in Marseille. So we need to get on the blower to Francois and dispatch him.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Without further ado, and hopefully get him to get it shut down. What a disgrace.
Huge news.
Tiramisu in Marseille. I'm seeing Smarties and Lotus, those funny little biscuits you get with coffee on top of the tiramisu. Oh, God, this is awful.
Marseille has never been part of Italy, has it?
No. Although there are quite a lot of... You'll find a lot of people with Italian origin in Marseille. Stefan Rosetto, one of my favourite riders, is from that neck of the woods. Rosetto, do you know what that means in Italian? Lipstick. Stefan Lipstick. Wow. As he should henceforth be
never
on the podcast.
Well, I never. Anything else from you, Lionel?
No, not really. No. No. Been deep in planning for the early part of 2020 this week.
Haven't you? You've been very busy.
So,
although, I mean, also,
can't say too much.
Also throwing wet towels over ideas that some of your colleagues have had.
I'd say a damp napkin over an idea that I didn't think was very good.
excellent.
But don't let me stop
you,
Richard.
Don't be discouraged, Richard. You know, back to the drawing board. Needs a bit of work, going back to the drawing board. All right.
So we're going back to the drawing board. Stefan Rosetta's not from Marseille at all. He's
Do you know?
I was going to say that.
He's best mates with Juan Alfredo, isn't he?
I think I've spoken to him about this. I think his family has Marseille origins.
But I'm so terrified of correcting you, Daniel. Because, I mean, basically, if we get into that particular arms race, I'll be blown out of the water, won't I, come the Giro next year. Being reminded 21 days in a row that this isn't the Dolomites. Got all that to look forward to, haven't you?
The Dolomites conspicuous through their absence in this year's Giro. There's one climb in the sort of the kind of bastard child of the Dolomites, the Dolomiti di Brenta, and that is the two climbs. I think Monte Bondone and Madonna di Campiglio, but otherwise no real. Solid.
Well, off you pop, Daniel, and book some accommodation for the Giro. Hope we've got that under control already.
Without further ado.
Shall we leave things there, chaps?
Indeed.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Yes.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.